This is the Pilot Photog Podcast. Let's listen to the interview with Future War Series author FX Holden. Hi, everyone. Today, my guest is author Tim Slee, who writes under the pen name FX Holden and writes some excellent military thrillers that I've actually been reading and highly recommend. How are you, Tim?
Yeah, good. Thank you.
So yeah, the Future War series, I'm actually in a third book. It starts with Kobani, then Golan, then the Bering Strait.
That's right.
You've got some excellent, excellent character development, some vivid portrayals of fifth generation fighter craft, such as the F-35 and of course the Su-57. Where do you get your sources to support these technical details that you elaborate on and expand so well?
I don't have any secret sources. That's the first thing to say up front. So there are nobody spilling manufacturer details to me. It's all open source information. The research I do is what I prefer, actually, is firsthand accounts from pilots who have flown the machines that that I'm writing about. And so I'll go all over the place to try and get this detail. Just as an example, there was a Norwegian pilot recently who's been to fighter school in the US. He was one of the people who qualified the F-35 for the Norwegian Air Force. And he had a firsthand account of his experiences with the F-35 in various training scenarios that he'd been involved in. It was in Norwegian, but I live in Denmark, so I can understand Norwegian. And I got in touch with him over the internet and just fleshed out a few more details of his experience. Nothing at all that you can't find in open source information, but just adding to the flavor of what he was saying in an article that he published openly on in the Norwegian press.
Excellent. As I said, you portray these very vivid encounters, very realistic, I think, encounters. If you had to explain your book series to someone who didn't know about or hadn't heard of it, what would you say that the Future of War series is about?
The Future War series started as an idea I had or always wanted to write about, which was what if you took the prototypes, the weapons that exist on the drawing board today and projected them into scenarios 10 years into the future and explored how they might be used and how they might influence the way wars are fought. And there are some really, really interesting lessons to be had when you play that mind experiment, because what we're more and more doing is taking the human out of the loop in warfare. And when we do that, we depersonalize warfare. And that can have big consequences in terms of strategy. And so those are the types of things that I try and explore, is if we have a future with a lot more autonomous weapons, if we have a future with weapons and AI that can do a lot of the decision-making for themselves, if you have politicians who might be more willing to, I don't know, engage in war or engage in conflict in a scenario where they weren't losing human lives by doing it, will they do that? And if they do, what would that look like?
Yeah, that does present a very interesting dilemma almost. There is no danger of a human casualty on the offensive side. You do spend a lot of time, as you mentioned, you know, talking about drone technology and how fighters can be used to control drones and deploy drones as forward reconnaissance and actually offensive platforms. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how those tactics, as you mentioned, evolve and kind of change the role of air combat?
I mean, one of the big challenges that that we will have in the future when you see stealth fighters going up against stealth fighters is how are they going to engage each other when they can't see each other? Unless, you know, you're lucky to get a hit off a ground radar, then it's going to be very difficult for these two air forces two air platforms to match up against each other until they get within radar range where they can pick each other up. So how are they going to detect each other and fight each other when their strength actually lies in being able to attack each other at a huge distance? The loyal wingman concept that Boeing is working on, and there's also one by Kratos, involves putting good avionics and great sensors in low-cost drone platforms so that you can send them out, use them as sacrificial lambs to try and detect other aircraft or other targets on the ground. And then if they get knocked down, it doesn't matter, because behind them is the stealth fighter that's controlling them, or the ground pilot who's controlling them and sending data to the stealth fighter. And in that way, they're lifting that veil of stealth from their opponents before the pilot controlling them is even seen.
Yeah, and that raises another interesting question. I think the F-35, just as an example, has gotten a lot of flack and a lot of negative press for, number one, how expensive it's been, how long it's taken to develop. And a lot of aviation enthusiasts, let's say, do not think it's a good dogfighter. It's not as maneuverable as maybe an F-15 or an F-16 or an F-22. And many feel that it's therefore not an effective fighter. Can you talk about how being a drone controller makes the F-35 that much more effective, and it doesn't necessarily need to be the most maneuverable airplane to be successful?
Yeah, although I'd like to come back to that particular point a little bit later. But up front, I mean, if you have an F-35 or an RAF Tempest or an Su-57 Russian aircraft, performing the role of an airborne warning controller almost, or an airborne control aircraft, where they have two or three wingmen with good radar, maybe even armed, slaved to their aircraft, then they're more like a platoon in the sky than they are a single aircraft. And they can send those drones out to explore contacts. They can send them out to prosecute targets on the ground or in the air. And the pilot in that F-35 or Su-57 is actually more like a quarterback than they are a single pilot. It's a very big force magnifier for them. So again, as I said before, the idea that they would never actually come within basic fighter maneuver range so that they would be dogfighting with anybody is an attractive one. One of the things about the F-35, and there are a lot of detractors, and I have no special insights, but again, when I am writing, I rely on secondary source information from people who have actually flown the aircraft. And of course, there's the limit to what they can say. But for example, I was recently reading a research by a conservative think tank. Now, of course, they have their own agenda, and you always have to think about the motivations of the source that you're reading. But this conservative think tank had interviewed 31 different pilots who have flown the F-35, and they did a summary of it. And you'll see this reflected in the books when I'm describing dogfights that the F-35 is in, but also the F-35's ability to avoid missiles when it's targeted itself. They speak very much about the ability of the F-35 to use rudder-assisted turns. And so, yes, it can't yank and bank like an F-16, but it does have ability to maneuver that an F-16 doesn't. And the Norwegian pilot, for example, that I recently had contact with, was saying that when he went up against an F-16, he also went up against Eurofighters, he was able to stay on their six, to stay behind them, using this ability of the F-35 in a rudder-assisted turn. It can turn very flat and stay in control. The other thing that that he said was that it has an angle of attack advantage that he's never seen in any other aircraft he's flown, and that means that he can keep his nose pointed at the enemy in situations where he wouldn't be able to do that in an F-16 or a Eurofighter.
That's interesting. I'd never heard that about the rudder-assisted turns and basically the high alpha maneuvers, right? I mean, it sounds like it's optimized for that. Very interesting. Just quickly off topic, I do videos about the F-35, and you see all these comments about it's a terrible airplane and we need more, you know, F-15s and F-16s. And those aircraft absolutely have a use. But it's very telling to me that you see more and more nations adopting or choosing the F-35. I think the most recent one is Switzerland, who has at least signed an agreement or a deal, it looks like, to procure F-35s as their next fighter. So they know something that we don't, right?
Well, I guess they're speaking to these pilots. But the other thing, I mean, Switzerland is a good case. The other thing you hear about the F-35 is that the lifetime maintenance costs are prohibitive and that the purchase cost is prohibitive and so on. Switzerland, the deciding factor in it choosing the F-35 in that deal was its cost advantage. And I don't think the Swiss are the kind to throw money around.
No, I think the more F-35s are produced, the lower the unit cost becomes over time. I think now they're down to 78 million, the last I looked.
Right.
A copy. And the Eurofighter, I think it's 120 million or 115 million, somewhere around there.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it, how many experts there are on the F-35 amongst the aviation community and And it's not to say anyone is more correct or less correct than the other. I wouldn't know. But if you think back to aircraft in history, you look at something like the MiG-21. When that came out, the US got a hold of a MiG-21 that was sent to them by a defector or stolen for them by a defector. When they evaluated it against the F-4, the F-105, they wrote it off as an inferior aircraft. And actually, in the early days of the Vietnam War, the MiG-21 shot down a lot more F-4s and F-105s until they learned how to fight against it. The same thing happened with the Spitfire. Actually, if you go back to World War II, the Germans got a hold of a Spitfire and did an analysis of it, and they decided that it was a piece of garbage because the engine cut out when it went into a positive G bunt. And what kind of fighter aircraft could fight if the engine kept cutting out? The thing is, and this will be the case for the F-35, pilots learn to fly the aircraft, and they become able to overcome the disadvantages and take advantage of the positives with the way the aircraft flies. The Spitfire ended up being one of the best fighters in World War II because the pilot didn't ever put it into a nose-down positive G dive. They would roll it on its back and then pull their stick back and they would dive that way. They never got into the situation where their engine was cutting out. The same with the F-35. This Norwegian pilot was saying that he looks forward to learning to fly it better. And he learns every day. Every time he goes up, he says he's flying it better. And I think that's the case.
Yeah, we're definitely in a generational shift because you have a lot of older pilots or generals or commanders that grew up or flew or learned how to fly fourth generation fighters. So their tactics are suited to that, those platforms. But now with this whole entire new generation, like as you said, pilots have to learn how to fly it better and also update or adapt new tactics. You actually do discuss this in one of your books, I believe the Russian Su-57 pilot who is dealing with his commanding officer sending in the Su-57s as if they were fourth generation fighters, and he's trying to adopt fifth generation tactics. So can you talk a little bit about that as it pertains to your book series?
Yeah, I mean, one of the characters in the book is a young pilot. I gave them the name Felon Babies, and it was because I was talking to a colleague. What I do when I write my books is that I put together a beta reading team. This is not unusual, but a team of experts, preferably people with various backgrounds, whether it's military or non-military, but with specialization in electronics or radar, or people who have been pilots, people who worked in the Marines, served in the Marines, people who've served in the Navy. And one of these guys was saying that when he was trained on the F-16, they put together a group of pilots who had qualified, obviously, as fighter pilots, jet pilots, but had never flown the F-16 before, hadn't flown any other comparable fighter, because they wanted them to learn how to fly the F-16 as the F-16, not to transfer any bad habits they might have had from previous training or previous aircraft, which I thought was an interesting idea. So the idea in the book is that this pilot comes up as a Su-57 felon baby who's only ever been trained or only ever flown on the Su-57. So he doesn't have the bad habits of the past. And the way he wants to, and I put myself in his shoes, the way he wants to fly the aircraft is not in formation with other aircraft providing support for each other, but and in that quarterback role that I was discussing earlier, where because he is never alone in the sky, he can actually roam far and wide. And if you have a four-plane unit, you can roam far and wide. You can cover a 100-mile front instead of a 20 or 30-mile front, because your four aircraft, even though they're not in contact with or not in visual contact with each other, are always in contact with each other through the data that they're sending to each other and the radio communication. So, yeah, the idea explored in the book is if you throw away the old strategies and adopt new strategies where you're actually playing to the advantages of these units, which are platforms which are just as powerful because of the data that they can assimilate as they are because of the weapons they can carry, it'll be a different war.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, the modern fighters today are more akin to supercomputers, right, than they are to just, you know, flying platforms. And information and sensor data is a huge, huge component of fifth generation aircraft with sensor fusion. The philosophy behind the F-35, I feel, is a little bit different than behind the Su-57. Can you discuss a little bit about what you see as the doctrine differences between the U.S. and NATO aircraft versus maybe Russian aircraft when it comes to the fifth generation platforms?
Well, the main one is that the Russian Su-57, as far as I can see, we don't know anything about how stealthy it really is. The main difference, as far as I can see, is that they haven't dropped the Russian emphasis on their aircraft being super maneuverable with thrust vectoring engines and the control surfaces that mean that they can perform absolutely amazing maneuvers. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but have you seen the Su-57 video that was done at the MAX 19 air show about 2 years ago?
No, I haven't. I've seen some of the Su-27 footage, which that can do amazing maneuvers, but I'll definitely check out the 57 at MAX 19.
Yeah, the Su-57 that flown by one of the Su-57 pilots, test pilots at MAX 19. There's a video there from the videoed in Russia at the MAX 19. The maneuvers that plane can pull off are absolutely insane. Everything that the Su-27 could do and better. And this one point there where it actually looks like it's flying backwards, it's an optical illusion, but it is insane. And that's the main difference, that Russia hasn't given that up. And it was interesting, I was reading, so what is the advantage of super maneuverable aircraft if you're engaging each other at beyond visual range? You're not in a dogfight. So why do you need a super maneuverable aircraft? That's a question that a lot of people ask, because what good is it when you're firing missiles at each other from 50 miles away? There was actually a Chinese engineer, avionics engineer from the Shenyang Corporation. And of course, again, you need to look at your source of your information. He's not necessarily particularly disposed towards US aircraft. And so he was talking up the Su-57. But what he said was, that this super maneuverability is going to be a huge advantage in evading enemy missiles. So yes, you're not dogfighting with an F-35 or even any other American aircraft. You're not dogfighting them within visual range, but you still have to be able to dodge the missiles they're firing at you. And being super maneuverable is not going to be a disadvantage in that respect. The more maneuverable you are, greater the chances you're going to be able to dodge a missile.
Yeah, and that's an excellent point for defensive countermeasures, which we think of flare, chaff, electronic jamming, but maneuvers are most definitely a part of that, and I think that gets kind of overlooked by many people. One of the characters that you have in your books, that I've really enjoyed reading is Karen Bunny O'Hare. I believe she's the Australian F-35 pilot. Can you talk a little bit about her maybe trajectory arc or her the inspiration you had for creating that character?
Yeah, we have a tradition in the Australian Air Force of female pilots, no different to any other air force in the world these days, but female fighter pilots. Our tradition only goes back probably 10 years. The Russians obviously goes back to the Second World War. I thought it'd be really interesting to write a character as a key protagonist in these novels who was a female fighter pilot. Incredibly inspiring stories from the Russian female fighter pilots of the Second World War. And then when you think about the type of struggle that it must be for any pilot to become a fighter pilot, let alone a female fighter pilot, I thought it would be good to explore. The character here is actually one that starts the books as a junior pilot in her first conflict, and it very quickly becomes apparent she's really not cut out for the Air Force. Basic ability to follow orders. I had one of the beta readers on the team said, look, she wouldn't even have got to the stage where she was deploying for combat. She would have been found out and thrown out before then, but that's not fun to write about. So she is found out during the first book. I don't want to spoil anything, but she doesn't come out of that first novel particularly well. But then that spirit that she has of constantly questioning authority, constantly questioning accepted doctrine, constantly questioning technology, was one that I is very useful in these books, because that's what I'm doing. So she's doing it for me. She never takes anything at face value. She doesn't take anyone at face value. She has to prove the technology for herself, and people around her have to prove themselves to her in order to be accepted. So that's the premise behind that character.
Yeah, that's a wonderful concept to explore, and I think you've done it brilliantly with the character, and it's a very fun read. I'm three books in. I believe right now there are five books that have been released. Is that correct?
Yeah, there are five, and the sixth one will be out this Christmas. The beta team has been put together, and we've got some pilots, some Navy officers. We've got some U.S. Marines. We've got a German radar technician. We have a Ukrainian tank driver on our beta team for the next one.
Awesome. And will that be the last in the series, or is this going to be an ongoing series?
When I run out of ideas for future conflicts, I think it'll be the last in the series. This one, the next one, is about a conflict in the South China Sea, and after that, it'll be Korea.
Yeah, those are both very charged areas right now. I think there's a lot of good reading to be had there.
Yeah, I hope so. The idea is that I'm not writing Third World War novels. So these are as based in reality as I can get them. Strategic scenarios that people frequently comment are realistic. They're not overblown. It's not the end of the world. It's usually explored through the eyes of several minor characters rather than major characters, in a minor conflict rather than a major conflict.
Yeah, and again, they make for great reading. When it comes to having become a writer, what authors have inspired you?
This series actually was inspired by a particular author no one would have heard of here. And his name was Brian Callison. He was a British author. And the fantastic thing about, especially this one book that he wrote, which was called Dawn Attack, it's about the story of the British attack, British commando raid on Norway in the Second World War. Up in the Lofoten Islands. And what he did was he wrote the story from multiple perspectives on both sides, the German and the British. And that fascinated me. He wrote it about, I suppose, 20 years ago. This was a book my father had on his bookshelf. And I loved it because it was just about ordinary soldiers, sailors, and airmen on both sides of the conflict, and it didn't actually take sides. Obviously history and your own moral codex are going to tell you which side you want to be on, if it's the Germans and the Nazis versus the British. But when it's about the ordinary soldiers, sailors, and airmen who are fighting in the conflict, it's less about the ideology and it's much more about the personality of the individuals involved, and basically that none of them are evil. There is no real good guy, no real bad guy. They are soldiers, sailors, and airmen who are just doing what their country has put them there to do, and making their best, trying to get out of it alive. That was the author that was the inspiration for these books. And so every one of these books takes a similar sort of starting point, takes a starting point in the individuals involved in a conflict, on both sides, or even sometimes three sides of the battle, and looks at the world through their eyes without trying to draw too many big moral bows.
So you could say it's ordinary people caught up in extraordinary events or circumstances, and how do they perform, or what happens in those conditions, right?
Yeah, exactly. And they don't, I mean, it's not Game of Thrones, but they don't all make it through. Which is reality.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things I've enjoyed most about reading these books is, first of all, they're all very plausible scenarios. These could happen in 10 years or maybe less in some cases. But the way people respond, the way people react, there are no, you know, superhuman characters or characters with what they call plot armor, that nothing can happen to them. You really feel a sense of danger and tension for these characters. And the outcome is not obvious and it's not clear. And I think that makes for a very good story, a very good page turner.
Yeah. And of course, I've learned from all the the masters. I'm a fan of Clancy. I'm a fan of Cussler. I'm a fan of Dale Brown. And the reason I mentioned that other author was because the structure of these books is very different to the ones that they write. Topics are the same. They write much better than I ever will, but the structure is a little different.
Yeah, I do like seeing the perspective from both sides, or not at the super high level like commander or, you know, general leadership. It's the soldiers that are tasked with prosecuting these orders or these missions that they have to do and how they respond to it. And so where can people find your books? What's the best place to go to get copies of these? What do you recommend?
Unfortunately, it's Amazon, because if you're a person who believes that Amazon is an evil empire, I can't help you, because I only publish on Amazon. You can get paperback or ebook there. The reason I only publish on Amazon is because Amazon, unfortunately or unfortunately, is almost a monopoly on ebooks. Yes, I know you can get them on Apple Books and there are other sources, but they have more than 80% of the market. And yeah, I put my energy into that 80%.
Yeah, you have to get the most exposure possible.
I haven't tried to get a traditional publisher. I have a traditional publisher for my contemporary fiction. I haven't tried to get a traditional publisher for this series. It's not that I wouldn't entertain it, but to be absolutely honest, if you're able to make a go of it as an independent author on Amazon, the royalties are just so much better.
Interesting. I didn't know that. So it's more beneficial as an author to be on Amazon then, correct?
It's incredibly more beneficial. As long as you can navigate that Amazon environment, if you have basic marketing skills and you're able to navigate the platform, it's so much better. That my royalties as an author with a publishing house are 10% of sales. My royalties with Amazon are 70.
Wow. Yeah, that's an incredibly large difference. What advice can you give to people who are thinking about becoming writers or are interested in the craft of writing?
I have just two words to say, and that's called it's just write. Just start. Just write. Write as much as you can. Write as often as you can. Don't panic about whether it's perfect. Send it to as many people as you want. Your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your friends who you're not afraid to lose. Send it out there. Get as much advice as you can. Just keep writing. If it doesn't work, write something else. And that was basically my secret the whole way through, is that anytime I was writing, I would have two or three projects that I was working on. If one people didn't like, I could go with the other. If they didn't like that, I would go with the other until eventually something hit the wall and stuck.
That is fantastic advice. And really, it is just a matter of sitting down and writing and writing every day if possible, correct?
Yeah, there's a lot of different ways to do it. So a lot of people take, especially if you've got a day job, take some time out and lock yourself away for 2 weeks and see how much you can get done. But I'm a fan of the Elmore Leonard school of writing. Elmore Leonard was a crime writer, or an American crime fiction writer. He wrote at least one book a year, sometimes two books a year, even while he was working full-time as an advertising executive. And the way he did it was that he wrote 2 hours a day.
Wow.
Every day. So he would get up at 5 a.m. and write till 7 a.m., or he would come home at 6 p.m. and write till 8 p.m. He wrote 2 hours every day. Within a half a year, he had a book. Then he would edit it, throw away half of what he'd written, and that's what he ended up publishing. Again, it was the principle is just write. You can't get published unless you do that. And he was the perfect example of that. I think he wrote 111 books in his lifetime.
Wow!
If you like crime fiction, crime noir, he has 100. Or so titles. He also wrote westerns, but a lot of his books have been turned into films.
Yeah, with that many titles, I can imagine that's just a prolific amount of writing.
Yeah, insane.
I'd like to circle back to your beta team that you were mentioning earlier, and just kind of discuss that process. So you mentioned earlier your beta team, and it's kind of a group of experts that help you produce or validate some of the technology that you're writing about. Can you talk a little bit about how you met or became friends with the people in the beta team and what that process is like?
Well, the first time I was putting together a beta team was actually for the novel Bering Strait, which I think you said you just started reading. Bering Strait was the first one I wrote, but it's the third one in the series in terms of time frame. But with Bering Strait, I had an idea of what I wanted to write about, and I wanted to write about technology, military technology and its application in the future. I don't have a military background. I have an intelligence background. So I can easily set myself in the strategy side of things, technology side of things. I needed help. And I had no idea where to get that help. So what I did was, there are various forums on the internet for people who are soldiers of fortune, mercenaries, contract security people. I thought to myself, okay, how am I going to attract some of them to help me? I'm not going to pay them. So what I did was, I went on there and I said, look, I'm going to give 20% of the proceeds of this book to charity. I need people to give me advice on aircraft technology, radar, naval technology, land warfare technology. If you're interested in helping, like I said, you'll be helping with a project where money goes to charity. I didn't think anybody would be interested. Straight away, I got 10 people.
Wow.
And they were from all walks of life. There were Germans, there were Russians, there were people from Australia, two Brits, a female pilot from New Zealand who actually is a pilot instructor. I got a Texas SWAT team instructor.
Oh, wow.
So in Bering Strait, there's a scene where Russian commandos attack a U.S. base and try and take it over. He actually wrote that scene, not in practical terms, but in general terms. He described to me exactly how that scenario would take place. And if it was an airbase takedown, then this is what would happen. That's basically why a lot of people think they're so authentic. They're authentic. If they are authentic, it's because the meat of it comes from these beta advisors.
Yeah, that's interesting. I actually did read Bering Strait first and then realized Kobani was the first book in the timeline, went back and read Kobani, and I'm reading Golan now.
Right.
As you've written more books, has that beta team grown? Has it stayed the same amount of members?
Oh, it's different every time. It's different every time. It's usually 6 months, sometimes even longer between a book. So people come and go. There are a couple who've been there from the start, and they extremely valued, but they're also a little bit invested in the series, right? So they're not going to be as good at seeing when there are flaws. It's great to have a whole lot of new people on the group who are also bringing new ideas, but they're also looking at the series with new eyes, and they may not be so kind.
Yeah, and I guess they're more objective, right? They don't have a bias towards.
Yeah, that's right. They are more objective. They very quickly get invested. So it's funny how people. We had to in the first group with Bering Strait. We had a Ukrainian and a Russian in the beta team, and we ended up having to say goodbye to the Ukrainian colleague because he simply couldn't be unemotional about things. He was very emotional about anything to do with the Russian element of the book. And in the end, he admitted himself, look, this isn't good for my mental health, so I'm going to quit.
Some of it is, in a way, it's hard to read because, you know, we all have our, I guess, political motivations or affiliations or identities, let's say. And so, you know, you don't want to see, quote unquote, your side losing or anything like that. But it makes for a good story. And it really makes you think about the direction that we're headed as far as our tactics, our strategies and everything else. I find it's really good food for thought. Thanks for listening to the interview. If you're looking for a good series to read, I highly recommend FX Holden's Future War Titles. I'll leave a link in the show notes.